This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
My guest today is Barron's Associate Editor, Eric Savitz, who covers the world of tech from the heart of Silicon Valley. Next Tuesday, Eric will launch his own monthly Barron's Live call, named Tech Trader, like his Barron's column. He'll be interviewing executives of well-known tech companies and other players in the world of tech. But today, he's playing the role of guest speaker, and we've got a lot to discuss. Eric, let's get started with the calendar. Yesterday marked the end of the first quarter, and it was pretty disappointing for tech. The Dow Jones Industrials finished the quarter up 7.8%. The S&P 500 gained 5.8%, but the tech-heavy NASDAQ composite, which is really a benchmark for technology stocks, rose only 2.8%, and much of the gain owed to yesterday's advance. What's been ailing the sector, which performed so notably well in 2020?
Well, I think there's a couple of things at play. So one, as you point out, these stocks had a spectacular year in 2020, outperformed the market, led the market higher. And in fact, we're really one of the only places where you could find reliable growth, in what was a very difficult economy, obviously, from the pandemic. It was hard to find places where you saw growing sales and in some cases growing profits. And people flocked to technology stocks. Now, I think there are a couple of things that happened, right? As we know, some parts of the tech economy, for example, cloud computing services, saw an acceleration in their business as companies moved a lot of their operations to the cloud. And then on the consumer side, we had a whole host of things that changed as a result of the pandemic. We saw a lot of people using video conferencing services and streaming video and buying, switching to e-commerce. And all of those kinds of stocks did really, really well. Now, of course, what's happened now is several things. One, there was just some profit taking. I mean, some of these stocks had triple digit gains last year and deserved to have some consolidation here. A second element of this is investors have started to look ahead to the reopening of the economy and looking at other opportunities for growth and for things were kind of ignored during the downturn, and suddenly are looking at industrial stocks and at hospitality stocks and travel and retail and restaurants and things that didn't fare very well during the pandemic for obvious reasons. So there's that element. And then another key element of this is very high-priced technology stocks tend to do badly when interest rates are rising. And we have seen a spike in the 10-year treasury not quite doubled, I guess, off of the year-end level, but has really accelerated. And that's because we anticipate, the market anticipates a sharp growth in the economy later this year and maybe perhaps some inflation. All of that leads to higher rates. Higher rates tend to be bad for very high growth tech stocks. And so one thing that has happened in the tech sector is we've gone from the super high priced ones leading the market to the super high priced ones lagging the market, and investors are switching to things that look a little cheaper, even in the tech sector.
It's part of a natural rotation, I suppose you'd expect, as the economy reopens and starts to run hotter.
Yes.
So you wrote an interesting and, from my perspective, somewhat alarming Tech Trader column in last weekend's Barron's, speaking of high-priced stocks. You wrote the piece based on research by Tony Sakanagi, who's a longtime tech analyst at Bernstein, and he found that tech stocks trading for more than 15 times sales in the period from 1970 to 2000 suffered sharp losses in the years that followed. Today, we've got a lot of tech stocks trading for more than 15 times sales, and many of them don't even have profits. I'm thinking of companies like Airbnb, DoorDash, Pinterest, Palantir, a number of them that came public just last year. What's your takeaway about the future of some of these companies based on Tony's research?
Yeah, no, Tony looked at, by the way, the research went from 1970 to 2020. So it's a 50-year time period.
Oh, 2020.
Yeah. Even so, And so he looked at how those stocks performed over long periods of time. So he went back each year and looked at any companies that had valuations above 15 times sales, and found that over almost any time period beyond the short run, so for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, those tend to be terrible performers. And that's maybe not that surprising, because you know we think of these as expensive stocks, and it turns out that expensive stocks get cheaper over time. There's several alarming things about what he found. One is that there has been a mammoth increase in the number of such stocks. So the number of companies trading at north of 15 times earnings in the tech sector
is at 15 times sales.
Excuse me. Yeah. They'd be bargains at 15 times earnings. At 15 times sales,
we would be scooping them up.
But yeah, so the number of companies that trade at that level is at the highest point since 2000, which of course was the height of the internet bubble. That is alarming by itself. He also saw an increase in the number of companies that trade at that kind of multiple that are losing money. So you've got a lot of stocks that are not making money, are trading at very high multiples of sales. It's a risky thing. I mean, you find that they underperform dramatically over time, and I think it's a sign of that some of the exuberance we saw in 2020 continues, despite the fact that some of these stocks really have come down in price. Stocks like Snowflake and Zoom and Peloton and some of these other high flyers from last year have come down. In some other cases, they've just kind of gone flatline, right? So Netflix, for example, is trading about where it was at the last summer. But nonetheless, you still have a lot of stocks that are trading very high multiples of sales. There's a lot of hope built in. And I think that's kind of concerning.
Well, if you connect the dots between Tony's research and our prior discussion about the rotation into other kinds of stocks that benefit from a stronger economy, it does suggest there could be some trouble ahead.
Yeah, I think there's some risks. I mean, that doesn't mean that, you know, tech as a whole is overvalued necessarily. I think you have to distinguish between, you know, the cheap ones and the overpriced ones. I have particular concerns about some of these very highly valued companies, but there are some cheap stocks out there. I mean, I think the irony is that the cheap ones tend to be the things that underperformed last year, hardware stocks. My phone's ringing. Sorry about that. The cheap ones tend to be hardware stocks and enterprise software stocks and... I think the market is logically looking for things that are cheaper, and there are some cheap tech stocks available.
Well, I'm going to anticipate listener questions, which we'll get to at the end of the call, by asking you, what are some of the cheaper stocks that you find attractive?
Well, so I think there. We've written about some. So I did. I did a feature a few weeks ago, for example, about Oracle, which changed very low multiples of sales.
That was an excellent cover story.
Thank you. There was another piece I did recently is on a company called Splunk, which is a data analytics company that also trades at very low multiples of sales and is going through kind of a transition in the way they do revenue recognition that has caused some disruption. I think there's some opportunities selectively in some parts of the chip business, which we can talk about, although many chip stocks are expensive. And I also think there are still some opportunities in some of the reopening plays. I'm intrigued by, for example, Lyft in the car, in the ride-sharing space. I've written about Yelp, which... is of course a recommender of local services, right?
Which we might actually use again.
Yes, we might actually go to some restaurants and retail stores. The other thing that they do that I think is interesting is a lot of their revenue actually comes from the recommendation home service providers, plumbers, and contractors and those kinds of people. There's currently kind of a shortage of supply there, and there is some pent up demand for those kinds of services. If you or any of our listeners have recently tried to do any home repairs, you'll realize that that it's often hard to book what you want, and there's that part of the market also is kind of opening up. They've also kind of changed their market a little bit. Yelp has to be a little more self-service in the way that they provide advertising to their customers, and so I see an opportunity there as well. And you know, I think the other thing that is interesting is that the very largest players, the FANGs, as we like to say, those stocks are less expensive than a lot of the other high flyers. So you know, you look at stocks like I mentioned Netflix, but Netflix and Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Google, these stocks have barely moved since last summer. So while we have this notion that 2020 was a great year for stocks, for tech stocks, and it was, some of the most prominent names are kind of stuck in neutral, and nothing fundamentally terrible has happened to their businesses. The market has just lost some attention. There's probably a little bit of concern about regulatory issues, but I think overall, that's a more interesting place to look right now, say, than the cloud names.
That's very interesting. And some of their businesses have actually gotten stronger. But I wanted to circle back to Apple. Tony Sakanagi had a pretty bearish take on Apple, which you wrote about in your column last week. And I thought it was very interesting. He noted a lack of buzz about the next iteration of iPhones and tougher comparisons for Macs and iPads. And he was rather skeptical about the outlook for an Apple car, which has been talked about quite a bit. Mm-hmm. What do you make of his assessment?
Yeah, so I think there's, as you say, there's multiple parts here. I mean, you know, Apple shares appreciated more than 80% last year. So they were a spectacular place to invest in 2020. They've gone nowhere this year. And again, I think Tony's right that there are a couple of reasons. So last year, the stock ran up spectacularly in advance of the launch of the iPhone 12, which happened in early October, and then appeared gradually on the market during the course of October, November. There was an anticipation this would be a landmark launch, probably the best iPhone launch since like the iPhone 6, which I think was in 2014. You know, these are the first 5G iPhones, and that there was a lot of pent-up demand. And they, in fact, have been doing extremely well, particularly the high-end ones. In fact, he and some other analysts have pointed out that the average price for iPhones is actually going up because consumers seem to like the expensive ones rather than the cheap ones. Now, on the other hand, if you think about 12 months ago, we were all getting super jazzed about the iPhone 12. There's almost no buzz about what will be the next round of iPhones, which is coming up in September. They almost always launch their new phones in September. There tends to be this pattern with Apple that you get kind of a big year and then kind of an incremental year. And this is viewed as probably an incremental year for the iPhone. And so there's not much buzz about that. So you've lost that element. And now the second part, which as you mentioned, is we had great sales last year for iPads and Macs. And for kind of the obvious reason, which is we were all stuck at home. Everyone was working from home and learning from home. Often you had multiple people in the same household trying to be online at the same time, and they needed to buy more devices. So they sold a lot of Macs and a lot of iPads. That same phenomenon, by the way, also helped Dell and HP, which also sold a lot more PCs than
almost any consumer tech hardware company.
Spectacular. And in fact, not just the PCs, the risk of getting sidetracked, but also anyone who made peripherals for PCs. So if you made mice or keypads or microphones or webcams or like anything that you would use in a home office setting,
we bought it last year.
We bought it last year. Right. So now the anticipation is that you just have a harder comp, right? Like, after such a spectacular year in 2020, it isn't, you know, and so many people bought new devices. There's some concern that this year you might see slower growth for those things, certainly making for a tougher comparison. And then the Apple car thing is interesting. I mean, I think, first of all, Apple has said nothing about an Apple car. Like, there's a lot of hints. They've hired certain people. They've got people look at their patent portfolio. And like, there's a lot of triangulation that would suggest there is something going on there. But Apple hasn't said anything. Apple moving into the car business is likely to take, assuming that it's true, is likely to take multiple years. And it's unclear how it will take shape. Will they build factories and make cars? That seems unlikely to me. They're not going to do the Tesla thing and make actual factories. They don't even make any of their own devices now. Why would they be making cars? That doesn't make any sense. Now, they could partner, and there's been a lot of speculation that they could partner with Kia or Hyundai or various other people. It is possible, but it is likely years away. And Tony's point, I think, is basically it's so far away that it's really hard to figure into your model for earnings, and he has nothing in his model. Earnings, because there's very little chance that in the next 2 or 3 years we'll see any real revenue there. There's one other element of this I think is important to keep in mind, which is that even if Apple is hard at work thinking about and developing cars, they have shown a clear willingness to pull the plug on big projects at the last minute if they don't think they have a real edge. And the best example of that is televisions, right? There was we at one point we all thought Apple was going to launch a line of like televisions, physical televisions,
right,
to compete with the Sonys and Samsungs of the world, and apparently there were prototypes. They got really close and apparently decided they just didn't have enough of an edge on what was in the market already and pulled the plug. They just abandoned it, and it would not be shocking. I'm not saying this is necessarily going to happen, but it would not be shocking if Apple figured out, well, maybe we don't really have an advantage here and decided to be an ingredient brand, right? The same way that you can, they provide CarPlay to the in-car entertainment service to multiple automakers already. And so they could do some things like that. Supposedly, they're working on LiDAR technology, which is used in driverless cars. Supposedly, they're working on new battery technology, which would be great. It's not entirely clear that the only value there would be to make their own cars. They could also license it to other people. So there's lots of possibilities. And Tony's view is just it's too early to include that. And so. I think what it boils down to is he just doesn't see a real catalyst for Apple here. Now, we'll see. I mean, Apple doesn't ever tell you what they're working on in advance. Right. And there's all sorts of other speculation about like virtual reality headsets and God knows what else. But Apple can surprise. Apple. We are on the first day of a new quarter for Apple. They'll report earnings towards the end of the month. It could be that they had a spectacular March quarter and that will, trigger more interest in the stock. But Tony just sort of thinks we're in a lull period at the moment.
Got it. It certainly is a beloved company, but that doesn't mean it's always a beloved stock. So right. I want to move on to talk about Micron.
Yes.
Before I do, I want to remind listeners that we will take calls and we will take questions at the end of the call. So, Eric, you've been bullish on Micron and Barron's, and I got to say, you're looking pretty smart these days. The company posted strong earnings yesterday. The stock is up more than 5% today on a very interesting report in the Wall Street Journal that Micron and Western Digital are both looking to buy a Japanese semiconductor company named I believe this is the name Kioxia.
Yes.
And Kioxia was formerly part of Toshiba. It was bought out in 2018 by an investment group led by Bain Capital. It's a very important company in Japan. And a deal with a U.S. semiconductor company would kind of put into play more of the geopolitics of the industry, which pits the U.S. against China in semiconductor production. So the prospect of a deal is fascinating for so many different reasons. What are you hearing and what do you make of this deal talk?
Okay, so this is a little complicated. Let's see if I can make it simpler. So for starters, there's huge demand right now for memory chips. There are basically two kinds of memory chips that are play here. One is called DRAM. DRAM is used in things like PCs and other devices. Then there's what's called NAND or flash memory, which is used in phones and other kinds of devices. But basically, those are the two types. There is effectively a shortage of both. There's huge demand right now from all the end markets that use memory chips. That includes phones, PCs, cars, all kinds of other devices. And as we know, as has been widely reported, there is actually a shortage right now of almost all kinds of semiconductors.
Right.
And as the economy reopens, it's becoming a more of a problem. So that has all contributed to higher memory chip prices and driven what were very good earnings and a better than expected forecast from Micron last night. Now, interestingly, the Wall Street Journal, like in the middle of the Micron analyst call yesterday afternoon, right in the middle of the call, the Journal posts the story that says, fascinating timing, right? They post the story that says both Micron and Western Digital are in talks to potentially buy Kioxia. Now, that is interesting for a few reasons. So first of all, Western Digital and Kioxia are joint venture partners. So all of Western Digital's memory capacity, it comes from its joint venture. There's actually three of them, but they're joint ventures to run semiconductor manufacturing plants together with Kioxia. And they kind of split the production together. They're probably, I don't know, there's something like a third of the market for flash memory. So these companies are very closely tied. So it's not surprising that this idea of them buying Kioxia would come up. The idea of Micron buying them is fascinating, because if you follow it to its logical conclusion, you then have Micron as the joint venture partner with Western Digital, which it competes, which would be a very strange situation.
Yes.
And so that would be odd. And then also you have the other phenomena that the Journal is saying in their story that the price that people are talking about is $30 billion. Well, you could think of Kioxia and Western Digital's flash businesses being sort of the same, right? Because they're basically 50-50 joint ventures that they operate together. And so the problem with that statistically is that, like, Western Digital's market cap is below $30 billion. So that would suggest that Western Digital is wildly undervalued.
Yes. By,
right.
Good
wildly
man.
Undervalued. Which is interesting. And then you start kind of trying to take this apart. I wrote something for the website this morning there's an analyst who basically asserted that what could happen is that maybe Micron will actually end up buying Western Digital, which would then allow the in that scenario, Micron would buy Western Digital. Micron would get additional capacity, the memory chip joint venture would stay in place. It raises questions about then what happens to Western Digital's other business, which is making disk drives. That was their original business, of course. So it's very complicated, but I think what you get to at the root of the story is there's a shortage of capacity. There is huge amount of demand for these chips. The shortage is not likely to be alleviated anytime soon. It's very hard to add capacity. It takes a long time to build a chip factory. And there are only a handful of players. By the way, there was a previous round of consolidation. SK Hynix, which is a Korean chip company, is in the process of buying Intel's flash memory business. So there's only a handful of players. Samsung is the other large player here. To your point, there are some tricky international elements to this story. The Japanese are likely to be very sensitive about an American company buying one of their kind of crown jewel technology businesses. It's going to be fascinating. The Journal says something could happen before the end of the spring.
We're going to keep watching this story and discussing it.
Yep.
And The world is running on semiconductors, and we've got to have them. So it's going to be interesting to see how the industry shapes up in the coming year.
Yes.
I want to spend a minute. We have a lot of questions about semiconductors from our listeners, but I want to spend 1 minute talking about the IPO market. It was on fire last year. This year, things have cooled a bit, but Coursera, the online education company, had a spectacular first day of trading yesterday. The stock came public at 33. It closed 36% higher at 45. When I looked today, it was up another 10%. The ticker is COUR. What do you think explains the market's enthusiasm?
Well, I think there's a couple of elements here. So Coursera is a fascinating business. So they're an online education company. They partner with universities and other content providers to provide courses online. And in fact, 90% of the people who take those courses don't pay anything for them. You can just watch them. Anybody can take a course. If you want to get credit for it or like a certificate or something, then you would pay for the course. They also provide a lot of job training. So they partner with, in particular, with tech companies. If you want to be a Microsoft certified engineer for a particular one of their applications, you can take those courses on Coursera. They saw a big boost from the pandemic. So they had revenue growth last year of 59%. So that's eye-opening. They're not making money currently. I talked to Coursera yesterday, and they think they can. They're not going to continue to grow at 59%, but they think they can grow north of 30%, almost for years to come. That the demand for online education is growing rapidly. And by the way, there's only a handful of public players here. Chegg is one that targets a little bit different market, but that had a big run last year. And so people, I think, are interested in the opportunities in the ed tech market. And there's some others that like could go public in the months ahead. I mean, we'll see more. There's one called Course Hero that does some of the same things. But there's never been a huge winner in this space. Maybe it'll be Coursera. We'll see. But yeah, it's obviously had a nice debut. You know, priced at the top of the range, it was like 30 to 33, priced at 33. And as I look right now, it's at 48. So it's had an impressive debut. That is not true for every stock that's come public this year, as you point out.
Well, online education has been one of the great growth areas of the pandemic for obvious reasons.
Yeah, that is so absolutely true.
We'll be watching that. So we have a batch of questions. There's a question from Rajiv. Can you suggest any tech stocks geared toward Biden's infrastructure initiative?
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. So I think there's lots of things you can look at here. I'll throw out a few random ideas. One is, the plan includes a massive increase in electric charging stations for EVs, right? 500,000 new EV charging stations. That I would look not just at the companies like ChargePoint that are actually doing charging stations, but you begin to look at, well, what are the components inside those? There are a bunch of semiconductor companies that play there. I would think about design software, right? So if we're going to design many, many new buildings and pipelines and electrical system redesigns and all sorts of other infrastructure, that all requires design software. So that plays well for companies, say, like Autodesk.
I was thinking of them.
In the design space. If we are truly going to get to an expanded access of rural broadband, which is one of the main one of the components of the plan, that would suggest an opportunity for network equipment companies like Cisco. It also would suggest a potentially larger market for 5G handset makers like Apple and the chip makers that provide parts to them like Qualcomm.
I was thinking everything is chip related.
Yeah, so I think it only adds in a way to the
our dependence on chip companies and the attractiveness of
them. Yes, at a time when there's already a shortage. So that's a problem, right? So I think So there's lots of ways to play this. And, you know, it's going to be and by the way, like, this bill is early, right? So and there's a lot of moving parts. I think it's going to take some time to sort itself out. But I think that, you know, I would argue that the markets rally today is probably in part from an anticipation that, you know, with a plan this size, there are going to be many beneficiaries, many jobs will get created, and many companies will make some extra cash.
Even if it pushes interest rates up a bit and inflation up a bit. But
yeah, so I mean, that by the way, is one fear, is that, and you know, this doesn't necessarily help those cloud software companies that are not really infrastructure plays in the first place and don't benefit or actually, you know, are hurt by higher rates. So yes, there is some downside here, and there is some fear that this will heat up inflation. But it is likely to create jobs and to benefit, you know, people making real world stuff. I mean, I think that's sort of the key here, right? Is when you talk about infrastructure, this is about atoms, not bits. And so if you're going to build out networks, you need equipment, you need routers, you need computers, you need, you know, fiber. There's a lot of stuff that you need to make all those things happen, and there will be lots of beneficiaries.
You need a 21st century infrastructure. Anybody who's gone through the bridges and tunnels around New York knows that.
Yeah, those are 19th century.
Right. Another question from Hal. Do you think that the new Mac with the Apple chip could be transformational for Apple? This is the new Mac computer using Apple's own chips.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's already started to be transformational for Apple. I mean, I think you know, Apple has done this in the past. You know, they make the chips that are in their phones, for example. You know, they have recently switched to the ARM-based chips of their own design from Intel processors in a lot of their Macs. That's allowed them to have more control of the experience. One of the things that's, I think, foundational to the way Apple thinks about the world is they like to control the full stack from, you know, the chips through the hardware and the software. The more integrated the experience, they think the better that the experience could be for both their customers and for their developers. I think this only makes the Mac a more compelling opportunity. Now, the interesting question is what happens to PC demand over time? Right, as we were saying earlier, we've gone through a spike in PC demand, and you know, by extension, MacBook demand. Unclear how long that lasts, but I think this is clearly a positive for Apple, and you know, I expect you'll see them continue to develop some of their own chips.
Boy, we could talk all day about tech. There's a lot to discuss.
There is a lot to discuss.
Yep, that's all the time we have for today. I really want to thank you, Eric. It's been a great conversation. I thank our listeners for tuning in. Tomorrow is Good Friday, so the stock market will be closed and Barron's Live will not be broadcasting. But I'll be back on Monday at noon Eastern time to talk about stocks to watch with Ben Levison, our deputy editor. And Eric, as I mentioned, will launch Tech Trader on Barron's Live on Tuesday at noon, so you won't want to miss that debut. He'll be hosting on the first Tuesday of every month thereafter. Thanks again, Eric, and thanks to our listeners. Happy Easter to those who celebrate, and stay well, everyone.